And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, I want to continue my warning that you're not safe if you go to Sam's Club, especially in El Paso. All right, today is March 4th, 63rd day of the year. 302 days remain until the end of the year. On this day in history, in AD 51, Nero, who later became Roman Emperor, is given the title Princep Iuventutis, head of the youth. 306, martyrdom of St. Adrian of Nicodemia. 852, Croatian Trapir I issues a statute. This document's the first known written mention of the Croat's name in Croatian sources. 938, translation of the relics of the martyr Wenceslaus I, Duke of Bohemia, Prince of the Czechs. 1152, Frederick I Barbarossa is elected King of Germany. 1238, the Battle of the Sit River is fought in the northern part of the present-day Yaroslavl Oblast of Russia between the Mongol hordes of Batu Khan and the Russians under Yuri II of Vladimir Suzdal during the Mongol invasion of Russia. What became Russia? 1351, Ramathibodi becomes king of Siam. 1386, Władysław II Jagiello is crowned king of Poland. 1461, Wars of the Roses in England. Lancastrian King Henry VI is deposed by his House of York cousin, who then becomes King Edward IV. I think that's my ancestor. 1493, explorer Christopher Columbus arrives back in Lisbon, Portugal, aboard his ship Nina from his voyage to what are now the Bahamas and the other islands in the Caribbean. 1519, Hernan Cortes arrives in Mexico in search of the Aztec civilization and all the gold. 1628, the Massachusetts Bay Colony is given a royal charter. 1665, English King Charles II declares war on the Netherlands, marking the start of the Second Anglo-Dutch War. 1675, John Flamsteed is appointed the first Astronomer Royal of England. 1681, Charles II grants a land charter to William Penn for the area that would later become known as Pennsylvania. 1776, American Revolutionary War. Continental Army fortifies Dorchester Heights with cannon, leading the British troops to abandon the siege of Boston. 1789, in New York City, the first Congress of the U.S. meets, putting the United States Constitution into effect. 1790, France is divided into 83 departments, cutting across the former provinces in an attempt to dislodge regional loyalties based on ownership of land by the nobility. 1791, the Constitutional Act of 1791 is introduced by the British House of Commons in London, which envisions the separation of Canada into Lower Canada, Quebec, and Upper Canada, Ontario. 1791, Vermont is admitted to the United States as the 14th state. 1794, the 11th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution is passed by the U.S. Congress. And for those that are not familiar, the 11th Amendment restricts the ability of individuals to bring suits against states in federal court. That's more protectionist legislation, so to speak. 1797, John Adams is inaugurated as the second president of the United States and becomes the first president to begin his presidency on March 4th. 1804, Castle Hill Rebellion. Irish convicts rebel against British colonial authority in the colony of New South Wales. 1813, Cyril VI of Constantinople is elected Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople. 1814, Americans defeat British forces at the Battle of Longwoods between London, Ontario, and Thamesville, near present-day Wardsville in Ontario. 1837, the city of Chicago is incorporated. 1848, Carlo Alberto de Savoia signs the Statuto Albertino, which will later represent the first constitution of the Regno d'Italia. 1849, President-elect of the United States Zachary Taylor and Vice President-elect Millard Fillmore did not take their respective oaths of office on this date. They did it on March 5th, leading to the erroneous theory that outgoing President pro temp of the U.S. Senate, David Rice Acheson, had assumed the role of acting president for one day. He did not. 1861, the first national flag of the Confederate States of America, the Stars and Bars, is adopted. 1865, the third and final national flag of the Confederate States of America is adopted by the Confederate Congress. 1882, Britain's first electric trams run in East London. 1890, the longest bridge in Great Britain, the fourth bridge in Scotland, measuring 8,094 feet, is opened by the Duke of Rothesay, who later became King Edward VII. 1899, Cyclone Mahina sweeps in north of Cooktown in Queensland with a 39-foot wave that reaches up to 3.1 miles inland, kills over 300 people. 1908, the isn't that interesting? My system just went bananas. There we go. I'm getting tired. There's always something. 1908, the Collingwood School Fire in Collingwood, which is near Cleveland, Ohio, kills 174 people. 1909, President Taft used what became known as the Saxby Fix mechanism to avoid the restriction of the U.S. Constitution's ineligibility clause to appoint Philander Knox as U.S. Secretary of State. 1913, First Balkan War, the Greek army engages the Turks at Bazani, resulting in a victory 2 days later. Also in 1913, on this date, the United States Department of Labor is formed. 1917, Jeanette Rankin of Montana becomes the first female member of the United States House of Representatives. 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt becomes the 32nd President of the U.S. He's the last president to be inaugurated on March 4th. 1933, Frances Perkins becomes the United States Secretary of Labor, first female member of the United States Cabinet. Also in 1933, the Parliament of Austria is suspended because of a quibble over procedure. Chancellor Engelbert Dollfuss initiates an authoritarian rule by decree. 1941, United Kingdom launches Operation Claymore on the The Fulton Islands, the first large-scale British commando raid. Also in 1943, the Battle of the Bismarck Sea in the Southwest Pacific comes to an end. Also in 1943, the Battle of Fardikampos, one of the first major battles between the Greek resistance and the occupying Royal Italian Army, begins. It ends on March 6th with the surrender of an entire Italian battalion and the liberation of the town of Gravina. 1940, the Italians have never been great shakes at military operations since the end of the Roman Empire. 1944, after the success of Big Week, the United States Army Air Force begins a daylight bombing campaign of Berlin. Now, for those who are not familiar with Big Week, also called Operation Argument, was a sequence of raids by the United States Army Air Force and the RAF Bomber Command as part of the European strategic bombing campaign against Nazi Germany. They decided to attack the German aircraft industry. They wanted to get the Luftwaffe into a decisive battle where they could damage it so badly that they could achieve the Allies could achieve air superiority. The Luftwaffe was probably the superior force, but it got its head handed to it by the joint air operations of the the U.S. and Britain. 1957, the S&P 500 stock market index is introduced, replaces the S&P 90. 1960, the French freighter La Cubre explodes in Havana Harbor in Cuba, kills 100. 1962, a Caledonia Airways Douglas DC-7 crashes shortly after taking off from Cameroon, kills 111, the worst crash of a DC-7. 1966, a Canadian Pacific Airlines DC-843 explodes on landing at Tokyo International Airport. 64 people are killed. 1966, in an interview in the London Evening Standard, the Beatles' John Lennon declares that the band is more popular than Jesus now. Now, his ego was writing checks that he wasn't able to cash, frankly. 1970, French submarine Eurydice explodes underwater. The entire 57-man crew was killed. 1976, Northern Ireland Constitutional Convention is formally dissolved in Northern Ireland, resulting in direct rule of Northern Ireland from London by the British Parliament. 1977, the 1977 Barentsia earthquake in Eastern and Southern Europe kills more than 1,500. Most of the casualties were in Bucharest, Romania. 1980, nationalist leader Robert Mugabe wins a sweeping election victory to become Zimbabwe's first black prime minister. 1985, the Food and Drug Administration approves a blood test for HIV infection. It's used since that time for screening all blood donations in the U.S. 1986, the Soviet Vega 1 begins returning images of Halley's Comet and the first images of its nucleus. 1996, a derailed train in Wayawuga, Wisconsin causes the emergency evacuation of 2,300 people for 16 days. 1998, Oncali versus Sundowner Offshore Services. Supreme Court of the U.S. ruled that federal laws banning on-the-job sexual harassment also apply when both parties are of the same sex. 1999, Mazan Zainal Abidin of Terengganu is crowned as Sultan of Malaysia. 2001, BBC bombing. A massive car bomb explodes in front of the BBC television center in London. Injures one person. The attack is attributed to the real IRA. 2002, in Afghanistan, 7 American Special Operations Forces soldiers and 200 Al-Qaeda fighters are killed as American forces attempt to infiltrate the Shaikat Valley on a low-flying helicopter reconnaissance mission. 2009, International Criminal Court issues an arrest warrant for Sudanese President Omar Hassan al-Bashir for war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur. Al-Bashir is the first sitting head of state to be indicted by the International Criminal Court since its establishment in 2002. 2012, a series of explosions is reported at a munitions dump in Brazzaville, capital of the Republic of Congo, kills at least 250 people. 2015, at least 34 miners die in a suspected gas explosion at the Zayadko coal mine in the rebel-held Donetsk region of Ukraine. 2018, former MI6 spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter are poisoned with a Novichok nerve agent in Salisbury, England, causes a diplomatic uproar that results in mass expulsions of diplomats from all the countries involved. 2020, former daredevil Nick Lawenda is the first person to walk over the Masaya volcano in Nicaragua. 2021, according to QAnon supporters, former U.S. President Donald Trump will be inaugurated, putting guards at the Capitol on high alert out of fear of another attack on the U.S. Capitol. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. And holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day, Adrian of Nicodemia, Casimir, Felix of Rois, Giovanni Antonio Farina in the Catholic Church, Blessed Humbert III, Count of Savoy in the Roman Catholic Church, Paul Kufi in the Episcopal Church, Peter of Rapacarboni, Blessed Zoltan Meslini, and St. Casimir's Day in Poland and with Lithuania. Duh. All right, let's see. Okay. You know, until the ratification of the 20th Amendment, 1933, the official day for presidential inauguration was actually March 4th. Now, if the 4th fell on a Sunday, ceremonies are held on March 5th. Now, the first president of the United States, George Washington, was inaugurated to April 30th. You know, although Congress did schedule the first inauguration for March 4th, 1789, they were unable to count the electoral ballots as early as anticipated. Consequently, the first inauguration was postponed to allow the president-elect time to make the trip from his home in Virginia to the nation's capital in New York. Now, in celebration of his inauguration, March 4th, 1829, Andrew Jackson invited the American public to the White House. And overwhelming crowds ruined many White House furnishings and forced the new president to make a getaway through a window. Undeterred by the reception, Jackson continued to host public parties at the residence. And in 1821, President-elect Warren Harding set another inauguration first by traveling to the Capitol for his inauguration in an automobile. First time that had happened. With modern advances in communication and transportation, election officials and newly elected candidates no longer needed 4 months to gather election returns and get to Washington. And to maximize the transition period between Election Day and Inauguration Day and curtail a lame duck Congress in which members defeated in November served until March, the 20th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution was initiated. Ratified in 1933, and Franklin D. Roosevelt became the first president sworn into office in January. Now, on Monday, March 4, 1861, President James Buchanan and President-elect Abraham Lincoln left the Willard Hotel in Washington in a horse-drawn carriage bound for the Capitol and Lincoln's first inauguration. And at the Capitol, before hundreds of citizens, Chief Justice Roger Taney administered the presidential oath of office, swearing in Abraham Lincoln as the 16th President of the United States. Well, in an inaugural address delivered under the watchful guard of riflemen, Lincoln appealed for the preservation of the Union, which had been threatened by the secession of 7 southern states opposed to his policy against the expansion of slavery. Attempting to retain his support in the North without alienating the South, he called for compromise, promised he wouldn't initiate force to maintain the Union or interfere with slavery in the states in which it existed, but he did vow to retain federal property. So a month later, his refusal to surrender or evacuate Fort Sumter prompted the Confederates to launch the first attack of the Civil War with the shelling of Fort Sumter. While composing his inaugural address, Lincoln turned to 4 historic documents for guidance and inspiration, and one was by Daniel Webster, his 1830 reply to Robert Haney, President Andrew Jackson's Nullification Proclamation of 1832, Henry Clay's Compromise Speech of 1850, and the Constitution. Then on March 4, 1863, Lincoln signed an act creating Idaho Territory. And while the bill was passed on March 3rd, the enrolled bill wasn't signed by the Speaker of the House and the presiding officer of the Senate until the morning of March 4th. And after that, Lincoln got it for his signature. Captains Meriwether Lewis and William Clark crossed into Idaho at Lemmy Pass in 1805. At that time, approximately 8,000 Native Americans lived in the region. Originally, the Idaho Territory was part of Oregon and Washington territories. Fur trading and missionary work attracted the first settlers to the region. And, of course, more than 20,000 immigrants passed through southeast Idaho during the California Gold Rush of 1849. As Idaho approached statehood, mining and other extractive industries became increasingly important to the economy. And while its dependence on mining has decreased, the state, which produces 72 types of precious and semi-precious stones, is still known as the Gem State. Today, it's a top producer of potatoes and trout, Austrian winter peas and lentils, and tourism, of course. All right, on that note, I think we have finished what we can do in the way of history for this date. A couple more things. 1982, Canadian jurist Bertha Wilson becomes the first woman appointed to the Supreme Court of Canada. Well, let's see, is anything else worth discussing? I think that's pretty much got it. All right. You know, we've been talking about creatures of the night, monsters, maybe leftover dinosaurs. We're going to talk now about turning to Southern Oregon, the Klamath River Monster. The Klamath River is about 250 miles in length and takes its name from the Native American term for swiftness. Begins in the Cascades of Southern Oregon, extends down to Copcoal Lake south of the California-Oregon border. But the creature that was seen by Jeffrey Shaw and his wife on a warm summer day more than 40 years ago was anything but swift. According to Shaw, he and his wife had rented a pleasant wooden cabin at one particular stretch of the river, and on most days would sit near the water's edge with a couple of bottles of wine and a well-stocked picnic basket. And as somebody whose schedule with the military was hectic, the pair relished some much welcome peace and quiet while simultaneously communing with nature. And in hindsight, commune with nature they did. They had taken a 10-day vacation, and all was normal for the first half of the week. But 6 or 7 days into their break from the rigid confines of the Air Force, matters took a very weird and dramatic turn. On the day in question, the Shaw had driven 15 or 20 miles in search of a particular sandbank had been told about that was apparently the perfect area for a private waterside feast. And maybe some, shall we say, frolicking in nature. Unfortunately, they failed to locate the place in question, so as fate would have it, they stopped at a shady, grassy area about 200 or 300 yards from the edge of the water. With blankets and wine and a plentiful supply of food, they enjoyed a romantic lunch under a warm, sunny sky. Well, about 2 hours into their day of fun, Jeffrey Shaw's wife saw something out of the corner of her eye she thought was a large black bear ambling along at the edge of the woods and heading down toward the water. Concerned, she alerted her husband and pointed in the direction where the creature was maneuvering among the trees and the bushes. But after a closer look, they realized it was not a black bear. Shaw explained that as the trees and bushes became less dense, he and his wife got a much clearer view of the creature that was shuffling toward the lake. At first glance, he said, the creature was continually obscured by the woods and initially appeared to be only about 6 or 7 feet long, which is what led his wife to assume it had been a black bear down on all fours. But once they got a closer look at it, they saw that it was closer to 30 feet long and appeared to resemble either a giant snake or a monstrous eel. Now, both of the Shaws confirmed that the creature seemed to have great trouble moving on land. That's why they described its movement as shuffling. And they added that it seemed to wiggle from side to side as it moved. So its body appeared to be continually vibrating as it toward the water. Now, they weren't able to see the nature of the creature's head, adding that the whole thing reminded them of a big black pipe. They said it didn't feel frightened in the presence of this creature, only awestruck. And while they didn't actually see it enter the water, they were sure that was its ultimate destination. And at no time did it make any noise as it passed by, and it appeared not to notice them in the slightest. Well, on the following 2 days, they came back to that same spot, hoping to see this thing once again. Jeffrey Shaw even camped out one night at the water's edge, hoping to have a truly close encounter. But fortunately, or unfortunately, depending on your point of view, they didn't see it again. And whatever the true nature of the creature, it summarily failed to appear again for Shaw and his wife. So the Klamath waters continue to this day to keep a tight grip on its secrets. And of course, one historical creature that, in fact, even made a movie about it, the Kraken. The Kraken is a creature that features heavily in Scandinavian folklore and mythology. It's a terrifying beast, maybe most reminiscent of H.P. Lovecraft's fictional monster, Chulhu. Beast of the mysterious deep, the Kraken is a definitive sea monster, although not a sea serpent of the long-neck humpback variety. In many respects, the Kraken sounds like a strange combination of giant octopus and gargantuan squid. And certainly, both animals have been the ability to grow to significantly large proportions. The colossal squid, reaching overall lengths of up to 46 feet from tentacle end to tentacle end. The Kraken, though, is said to grow much, much larger, to the point where in centuries long gone, it supposedly drug ships under the water, drowned the crews in the process. The story of Arvar Oddr, a renowned Scandinavian hero of old whose adventures are chronicled in the 1200s, has a description of a beast called the Hafgufa, but which scholars of Scandinavian folklore and history believe it may well have been a kraken. According to this particular story, there are two sea monsters. One is called the Hafgufa, or the sea mist, and the other is the Lingbaka, or heatherback. The Lingbaka is the largest whale in the world, but the Hafgufa is the hugest monster in the sea. And it's the nature of this creature to swallow men and ships and even whales and anything else that gets within reach. It can stay submerged for days, and it rears its head and nostrils above the surface and stay that way at least until the change of tide. Now, according to the story told by this Scandinavian hero, the Lingbaka is a huge, huge, huge creature. According to Ogmund Tussock, supposedly sent these creatures by means of his magic to cause the death of Odd, as he was called, and his men. He thought more men would have gone the same way as those that had already been drowned, and he expected the Hafgufa would have swallowed everybody. Now, this is the story that was told by Orvar Oddr. Then there's the 16th century tome, Konungs Skuggsjá, which translates into English as King's Mirror. And it also describes in some detail a creature that's believed to be the Kraken. There's a fish that's still unmentioned, which it is scarcely advisable to speak about on account of its size, because it will seem to most people absolutely incredible. There are only a very few who can speak upon it clearly, because it's seldom near land or appears where it may be seen by fishermen. And there are not many of these creatures in the sea, but in their tongue and in this 16th century volume, they called it the Hafgufa. It went on to say, nor can I conclusively speak about its length and ells, because the times he has shown before men, he's appeared more like land than like a fish. It was so big, it was mistaken for an island. Neither have I heard that one has been caught or found dead. It seems to me as though there must be no more than two or three in the entire ocean, and I deem each is unable to reproduce itself, because I believe they're always the same ones. Then, too, neither would it do for other fish of the if the Hafgufa were such numbers, other whales, on account of their vastness and how much subsistence they need. It's said to be the nature of these fish that when one shall desire to eat, it then stretches up its neck with a great belching, and following this belching comes forth much food, so that all kinds of fish that are near, that are close by will come to the location, and then he'll gather them all together, both large and small. But this great fish lets its mouth stand open the while, and the gap is no less wide than that of a great sound or fjord. And no may the fish avoid running together there in their great numbers, but as soon as its stomach and mouth is full, it locks together its jaws and swallows all the fish. In addition, there's the words of the Swedish author, Jacob Wallenberg, on the page 1781 of his book, Menson Pa Galehan, which translates as My Son on the Galley, there's the following story. Kraken, also called the crabfish, which is not that huge for heads and tails counted. He's no longer than our omen is wide. That's less than 16 kilometers. He stays at the seafloor, constantly surrounded by innumerable small fish who serve as his food and are fed by him in return for his meal. Lasts no longer than 3 months, and another 3 are then needed to digest it. His excrements nurture in the following an army of lesser fish, and for this reason, fishermen's look for his resting place. Gradually, the kraken ascends to the surface, and when he's at 10 or 12 fathoms, the boats have been moved out of his vicinity, as he will shortly burst up like a floating island, spurting water from his dreadful nostrils and making ring waves around him. It can reach many miles from the source. This is the Leviathan of Job, according to many. And finally, there's an 1830 sonnet called The Kraken, which came from the acclaimed poet laureate Alfred Lord Tennyson. According to this, below the thunders of the upper deep, far, far beneath in the abysmal sea, his ancient, dreamless, uninvaded sleep, the kraken sleepeth. Faintest sunlights flee about his shadowy sides, above him swell huge sponges of millennial growth and height, and far away into the sickly light, from many a wondrous grot and secret cell. Well, I won't go into the second verse, which is worse than the first. Today, sightings and reports of the kraken are not just rare, they're non-existent. And this would suggest two possibilities to cryptozoologists. A, the kraken was purely a mythical beast, or it was hunted to extinction in centuries past. Whatever may be the truth of the matter, the kraken seemingly no longer endures. Its legend most assuredly does. Of course, we don't know what resides in the depths of the ocean. Well, let's talk about Lake Sturgeon's creature, far less well known than its counterpart in Loch Ness, Scotland. There's a mysterious beast that occupies Lake Sturgeon in Sweden. It's been seen on more than a few occasions. While many of the sightings are somewhat vague and open to interpretation, one that occurred in 1878 is not. It came from a man named Martin Olson, mechanic at the nearby Husterlin sawmill. He lived in a cabin at the edge of the lake, and he went into some detail in describing his encounter with the creature. He said, "I was fishing near Forson Island when I got a strange feeling somebody was watching me. I turned around and looked behind me, and the lake creature was not more than 40 meters from my boat. Well, I was so shocked, I dropped my pole and line in the lake when I saw it. Now, the weather was bright and sunny, and I got a good view of the creature. The neck was long, about as round as a man's body at the base, where it came up out of the water. Tapered to about 6 feet to a snake-like head that was larger than what I figured the neck could support. There was a hairy fringe just back of the neck, hanging down the back. This ribbon was stuck close to the neck, possibly to cause a wetness. Color was grayish-brown. Thing had two distinct eyes that were reddish in appearance. There were a couple of dark humps visible beyond the neck. Both of these humps and the part that was out of the water glistened in the sunlight. I didn't see any scales. There was a skin on the animal that resembled the skin of a fish. Now, I didn't want to alarm the animal, but I did want to get away as quickly as possible. And moving cautiously, I took my oars and pulled slowly away from the spot. I became even more frightened when I'd lowered about 10 meters distance, the animal began to swim toward me. I stopped rowing, and the creature stopped and just lay in the water staring at me. This went on for about 5 minutes. I'm uncertain because my mind was on anything but the passage of time. Now, there's no doubt in my mind this thing could have overturned my boat. I thank God when he dropped beneath the water, and I saw a blackish hump move out in the opposite direction. So clearly, Nessie is not the only creature of its type that exists in the lakes of this world. It's Lake Sturgeon in Sweden is a little-known sister lake of Loch Ness. So you have to wonder, is there an entire race of these creatures that we're not aware of? How about Lake Winnipegosis in Canada? In 1903, a man by the name of Oscar Fredrickson Winnipegosis in Canada, wrote a fascinating and extensive report on his knowledge of huge lake monsters in the near early decades of the 20th century. And all the stories he wrote came from witness reports, both first and second hand. And one of those he wrote was quite interesting for our purposes. In 1903, he said, "I lived with my parents on Red Deer Point at Lake Winnipegosis. Our house was situated about 200 yards from the shore. About a mile south of our place lived a man by the name of Ferdinand Stark. And one day, Stark was down by the lake shore when he saw what he thought was a huge creature in the lake. It was moving northward along the shore, just a short distance out. Stark wanted somebody else to come see this creature, and as we were his nearest neighbors, he came running along the lake to our place. And all the while, he could see the creature moving in the same direction that he was, only going a little slower than he was running. Well, Stark got to our house, very much excited and breathing heavily, and asked the writer's mother and father to hurry down to the lake to see a huge creature in the water. Well, by the time the parents got to the lake shore, there was nothing to be seen. Whatever Stark had seen had vanished. Looking somewhat bewildered, but still visibly excited, he began to describe what he had seen. He said he had seen, all he could see of the creature was its big back sticking out of the water. It was very dark or black in color. There were a number of seagulls following it, and they kept flying down to it as if they were picking at it. And the parents did see quite a number of gulls still flying around. In 1935, Mr. Cecil Rogers of Mafeking made a trip to Grand Rapids on Lake Winnipeg. And while there, they called on Mr. Valentine McKay, a resident of Grand Rapids for many years. And while they were talking, the conversation drifted to strange animals that existed at one time. And everybody surprised, McKay said he'd seen some such animal at Lake Winnipegosis. McKay was very pleased by the fact that Fredrickson took his story seriously and didn't poke fun at him. Prepared a carefully written statement for the monster hunter, which read, "In September 1909, I was traveling alone in a canoe from Shoal River on Lake Winnipegosis to Grand Rapids on Lake Winnipeg. At the time I saw this creature, I was standing on a lake shore. I had stopped at Graves Point to make tea. I was at the edge of the bush getting willows for a campfire when I heard a rumbling sound like distant thunder. And as I looked out on the glassy surface of the calm water, I saw this huge creature propelling itself to the surface of the water about 400 yards out from shore. A large part must have been submerged, judging by the great disturbance that it caused in the water. The creature's dark skin glistened in the autumn sun, and I estimated it was moving at a rate of 2 or 3 miles an hour. And as I watched it, a member of the body shot up about 4 feet vertically out of the water. This portion seemed to have something to do with the creature's method of locomotion. It was making towards Sugar Island or Sleep Rock. McKay said he watched it and was out of sight. And a number of gulls hovering around this creature followed it as far as he could see." Now, Fredrickson had something notable to say on this particular story. Mr. McKay said he had described this creature to a geologist by the name of Craig, who said it was quite possible that it was remaining specimen of a prehistoric animal that had once been plentiful in the area. Now, on the matter of the two men in question, Ferdinand Stark and Valentine McKay, Fredrickson went on to make a number of observations and comments. He said a great many people will think these two men just made up a story about seeing some strange animal at Lake Winnipegosis, but it's hardly probable both men will think up a yarn about the gulls. Stark and McKay never met, as far as I could find out. Stark moved from Winnipegosis in 1904 or 5, and if he's still living, Fredrickson hadn't been able to find him. And Fredrickson had yet another account to relate on this particular matter of an unidentified large beast on the loose in the early part of the 20th century. In 1934, Captain Sandy Vance lived at Graves Point. One day he was over at Sitting Island, which is on the northeast side of the point, and he saw what he thought was a huge animal a short distance offshore. He said it was the biggest living creature he'd ever seen in the water. Now, Vance had been captain of freighter tugs for many years on Lake Winnipeg and Lake Winnipegosis. He said he'd often seen moose and deer in the water, so there's no reason not to believe he saw some strange living creature. Well, Vance died a number of years ago, but he was well known, and his story was spread far and wide. And then there's another intriguing account from Fredrickson. There were quite a few natives who had seen some strange thing in the water. They called it the Big Snake. And those of Shoal River claim that a monstrous creature is often seen off Sugar Island and Steep Rock in Dawson Bay during the latter part of the 19th century. So clearly, there's a lot more in the world than we're aware of. In fact, the gorilla was thought to be a fable told by superstitious natives until one was encountered. And then, of course, let's not overlook the Loch Ness Monster. Now, everybody's heard about the Loch Ness Monster. A large number of people claim to have seen the long-necked, humped leviathan of the deep. Some have photographed it. Some have filmed it. Nessie, as the beast is known, has been a staple part of the world of the unexplained since 1933, when the phenomenon of the monster exploded in spectacular or worldwide fashion. Since that time, millions of people have come to the shores of the 22.5-mile-long, 744-foot-deep loch, all in the hopes of seeing the elusive creature. Attempts have been made to seek out Nessie with sonar equipment, aircraft, balloons, even submarines. Now, there's been a lot of theories put forth about what Nessie is, or far more likely and correctly, what the Nessies are. Certainly the most captivating theory, and the one that the Scottish Tourist Board, movie makers, and general public find most appealing, is that which suggests the creatures, and there's more than one, are surviving pockets of plesiosaurs. They were marine reptiles that the domain of zoology assures us became extinct tens of millions of years ago, but they said the same thing about the coelacanth, which was caught in 1939. Possibility the monsters are actually giant-sized salamanders holds sway in more than a few quarters, as does the idea that maybe massive eels are the culprits. And there are the scenarios involving sturgeon, oversized turtles, catfish, and even crocodiles, giant frogs, and hippopotami. To say the Loch Ness has an air and atmosphere of mystery and intrigue is about it is certainly an understatement. The gigantic loch is steeped in legend, folklore, mythology, and history. Lies along a huge fault line called the Great Glen Fault, the origins of which date back literally hundreds of millions of years. The fault runs through the Great Glen, which includes Loch Ness, Loch Lochy, Loch Oich, Loch Linne, and the River Ness and the River Lochy. Loch Ness is home to a nearly magical-looking 13th-century structure called Urquhart Castle. The date on which history was really made, as the newspapers and the public saw it anyway, was April 14, 1933. Although the facts didn't surface till May 2nd. May 2nd was the date when a man named Alex Campbell splashed a story across the pages of the Inverness Courier newspaper. And that story really drew people in. Campbell told of the encounter with an anonymous, well-known businessman and his wife, who lived near Inverness. Apparently, they'd been driving along the north side of the loch when they saw, to their amazement, a tremendous upheaval in the water. They watched in complete shock as a massive animal with a body not unlike that of a whale broke the water. Campbell upped the intrigue and sensational nature of the story when he added that the water churned like a shimmering cauldron as the demon of the deep provoked cold fear in that pair. Then there was July 22nd, 1933. Okay. July 22nd, 1933. Excuse me. Mr. and Ms. George Spicer saw the monster not in the water, but rumbling across the road down toward the water. According to Mr. Spicer, it was horrible, an abomination. It didn't move in the usual reptilian fashion, but an archer's. The body shot across the road in jerks, but because of the slope, we couldn't see the lower part, and we didn't see any limbs. He continued that by the time the shocked pair reached the section of the road where the monster had been seen, it had already gone. Nevertheless, evidence of its presence was still there. The surrounding bracken had been nearly flattened by something large and heavy. Two things, though, he was quite sure. The beast was at least 5 feet in height and quite large enough to have upset the car. Spicer went on to say that he estimated the length to be 25 to 30 feet. Its color, so far as the body is concerned, could only be called a dark elephant gray. We didn't see a tail, nor did I notice any mouth on what I took to be the head. We later concluded the tail must have been curled around alongside it, since there was something protruding above its shoulder, which gave the appearance that it was carrying something on its back. My wife and I were just absolutely amazed. It had been a loathsome sight to see that arched neck straggle across something with something that still haunts us. And so was born a mystery that more than 80 years later shows no signs of stopping. One perfect example of the fact that Nessie hadn't gone away, there's a case from the 2000s that remains a classic. 2007, one of the most amazing, significant encounters in a very long time occurred at Loch Ness. It was an encounter that both the Nessie-based research community and monster hunters everywhere practically foaming at the mouth with excitement. And this is hardly surprising, since the witness in question, a man named Gordon Holmes, succeeded in filming one of the world's most famous legendary beasts. And this wasn't a piece of vague or blurry footage of a questionable nature. It was clear enough for anybody and everybody to see. About 10 p.m. on May 26, 2007, Gordon Holmes filmed something in Loch Ness. It's something that turned him into an overnight media sensation. Certainly a brief sensation. The day in question was dominated by heavy rain, but which cleared as the evening arrived, allowing him to get clear footage of what looked like some kind of animal moving at a significant rate of knots in the water of Loch Ness. And the location from where all the action was captured was a parking area on the A82 road, just a couple of miles from Drumnadrossit. According to Holmes, I couldn't believe my eyes when I saw this jet-black thing about 45 feet long, moving relatively fast in the water. My initial thought was it could be a large eel. They have serpent-like features, and they may explain all the sightings of Loch Ness over the years. Longtime Nessie seeker Adrian Shine was moved to comment in a fairly positive fashion. He said, "I see myself as a skeptical interpreter of what happens in the loch, but I do keep an open mind about these things. There's no doubt that this is some of the best footage I've ever seen." He was careful to add that while Holmes might have filmed some biological creatures, there's always a possibility it could just be the waves of the loch. There might well have been a psychological phenomenon, as much as we see what we want to see. Then from Loch Ness, we go to Lough Nahuan and talk about that monster. There was, in 2015, original notes and files belonging to the late monster hunter, F.W. Ted Holliday, were made available. He spent a great deal of time in the 60s and 70s investigating the Loch Ness Monster. And among those notes was a summary report of an interview that he conducted with Stephen Goyne in July of 1968. Now, this wasn't at Loch Ness, Scotland, though. It was Lough Nahuan in Ireland that Mr. Coyne talked about. According to Holliday's notes, at about 7 on the evening of February 22nd, 1968, Stephen Coyne went down to the bog by the loch to bring up some dry peat. Took his eldest son, a boy of 8, with him and the family dog. Now, although the sun had set, it was still quite light. On reaching the peat bed beside Nahuan, he suddenly noticed a black object out in the water. Thinking it was a dog, he whistled, but the dog came bounding along the shore from behind him. When the dog spotted the object in the water, he stopped and started barking. At that point, Coyne saw that the object was an animal with a pole-like head and neck about 9 inches to a foot in diameter. It was swimming around in various directions. From time to time, it put his head underwater. Two humps then came into view. A flat tail appeared. Once this came out near the head, which argued length and high degree of flexibility, the thing was black, slick, and hairless, with a texture resembling an eel. The dog's barking seemed to irritate the monster and began to move inshore, its mouth wide open. However, when Coyne strode over to support his dog, it turned away and started swimming around the little loch. At about this point, the boy ran home to get his mother to come see the creature. Ms. Coyne and the children arrived. The Paisty, which is an Irish terminology for a lake monster, was busily patrolling the tiny lake. Both Mr. and Ms. Coyne agreed that the creature was about 12 feet long, and both agreed they didn't see any eyes. Ms. Coyne said that she noticed two horn-like projections on top of the head, and she thought the creature approached as near as 4 or 5 yards, but the husband felt the nearest point was about 9 yards. Both agreed the mouth was underwater and underslung in relation to the snout, and neither of them reported seeing any teeth. The mouth interior was described as pale. And to and fro before the 7 members of the Coyne family, this creature swam. As dusk was settling, they left it to make its own way, and they went home. Well, whatever the true nature of the Irish beastie of Loch Nuhun, it was never reported again. And from sea monsters, we're going to talk about one of their cousins, the mermaid. Now, the word mermaid is derived from a combination of mir, an old English word meaning sea, and maid as in a woman. And according to old seafaring legends, and mermaids would often deliberately sing to sailors to try and enchant them with the secret, malevolent intent of distracting them from their work and causing their ships to run aground. Other ancient tales tell of mermaids inadvertently squeezing the last breath out of drowning men while attempting to rescue them. They're all said to particularly enjoy taking humans to their underwater lairs. Hans Christian Andersen wrote The Little Mermaid, for example, and in that the mermaid forget that humans can't breathe underwater. Another legend suggests the sinister sea creatures deliberately drown men out of sheer venomous spite, no less. The fabled sirens of Greek mythology are sometimes portrayed in folklore as being mermaid-like in nature and appearance. Other related types of mythical legendary creatures that fall into this category include water nymphs, selkies, animals that can allegedly transform themselves from seals into human beings, and vice versa. Mermaids are noted in British folklore as being distinctly unlucky omens, occasionally foretelling disaster and sometimes even maliciously provoking it. Evidence of this, several variations of the ballad Sir Patrick Spens depict a mermaid speaking to the doomed ships. In some, she tells the crew they'll never see land again. In others, she claims they're near the shore, which the men are wise and astute enough to know means that deep, malevolent deception is at work. Now, the story itself is of Scottish origin and may possibly refer to an actual event, namely the bringing home of the Scottish Queen Margaret, maid of Norway, across the North Sea in 1290. But there is some speculation that the ballad may actually relate to a voyage by the princess's mother in 1281. But regardless of the truth of the ballad itself, its words are prime evidence of both the knowledge and the deep fear of mermaids that existed in the British Isles for an untold number of centuries. One such account tells of a deadly mermaid inhabiting a small pool in the pleasant little village of Charles Urquhart in England. 1893, the writer Robert Charles Hope penned the story. He said there was a mermaid seen there once. It was a good while ago, before my time. I dare say it might be 100 years ago. There were 2 men going to work early one morning, and they got as far as the side of the pond in the field, and they saw something on top of the water that scared them not a little bit. They thought it was going to take them straight off to the old lad himself. I can't say exactly what it was like. I wasn't there, you know, but it was a mermaid, the same as you read about in the papers. Well, the fellers had almost run away at first. They were so frightened, but as soon as the mermaid spoke to them, they thought no more about that. Her voice was so sweet and pleasant, they fell in love with her then and there, both of them. When she told them it was a treasure hidden at the bottom of the pond, lumps of gold and nobody knows what else, she'd give them as much as ever they'd like if they'd come to her in the water and take it out of her hands. Well, when they went in, it was almost up to their chins, and she dove into the water and brought up a lump of gold almost as big as a man's head. And the men were just going to take it, and one of them said, "Hey, excuse me, if this isn't a bit of luck." And at that point, the mermaid didn't take it away from them again and give a scream and dive down into the pond, and they saw no more of her, and neither got any of the gold, and nobody's seen her since. No doubt the story once ran that the oath that scared the uncanny creature involved the mention of the holy name. which would tend to support the idea that mermaids are evil. Moving on, there's a story of Mermaid's Pool, also known as Blackmere Pool, that can be found at the Staffordshire England village of Thorncliffe on the Staffordshire Moorlands. They're dominated by forests and lakes and rolling hills and crags. It's a story that dates back about 1,000 years. According to the legend, the story transpires that this particular mermaid was once a maiden of fair beauty, and it came to pass, for reasons that were never made clear, she was persecuted and accused of various crimes by a gentleman named Joshua Linner. Now, it isn't clear whether these accusations included being a witch or whether he may have just had his amorous advances rejected. That being said, Mr. Linner had the woman bound up and thrown into the bottomless Blackmere Pool. As she fought for her breath and life, the woman screamed vengeance on her accuser, Joshua Linner, and that her spirit would haunt the pool from that moment forward. And she swore that one day she would drag her accuser and executioner deep beneath the dark depths of the Blackmere Pool to his own death. Well, it's a recorded fact that 3 days later, Joshua Linner was found face down, dead in Blackmere Pool. When his body was drug out and turned over by the locals, to their horror, what was once his face was now nothing more than tattered shreds of skin. The injuries caused by sharp claws or talons. And situated barely a stone's throw from the Shropshire, England town of Newport, just over the border from rural Staffordshire, Aqua Lake Mere, 1.5 kilometers long and 0.5 kilometer wide, is the largest natural lake in the Midlands, but it's very shallow, extending down to little more than a uniform 3 feet. Legend has it that one day many years ago, when the mere was being cleaned, a mermaid rose out of the water, quite naturally scaring the living daylights out of the workmen, while simultaneously making shrieking, disturbing, and damning threats to destroy the town of Newport if any attempt was ever made to empty Aqualit Mere of its precious water. Well, very wisely, it would seem, the mere was not, and to date has never been, drained. Of course, it'd be interesting to see what would happen if it was. Now, tomorrow, I told you we're running out of time. Tomorrow we're going to talk about mermen, because where there are mermaids, there must actually be mermen, or you wouldn't have merkids. So until tomorrow night at this same time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.